everybody, and a welcome back to another episode of Hooked on Hitchcock. I'm your host, Jonathan Mitty, and I've got my awesome, awesome co-host here. How you doing, G. Larry Butler?
Oh, just fine, thank you. Hello, hello, hello.
You got your British accent going on there, right, mate?
Well, yeah, I'm just getting into character for Hitchcock.
I don't know. If you were getting into character, wouldn't you do like more of a French character? Because this movie that we're doing right now, I confess, takes place in Quebec, Canada.
Well, guess what? Most of the actors were German. What was that all about?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know what that was all about.
They really German actors. I think that's where all the Nazis went to after the war.
They went into that movie?
I didn't see too many French people.
I mean, he was doing a movie about like concentration camps at one point. So who knows? What?
Maybe he used the same cast.
Maybe. I don't know. It was a documentary about concentration camps. So maybe he's real Nazi, you know, people as I don't know. That's just a joke. I'm joking.
Startling revelation. They're all German.
Yeah, they're all German. That's crazy.
Husband.
Except for Montgomery Clift, who I don't think was German.
And he did say something in French to some boy who was waiting to have a confession. He said, "Moment," and a moment, you know, things like that. So anyway,
he did speak French every now and then. But so this is your first time watching it, and you watched it twice, and you talked about it earlier that you watched it twice. Why did you watch it twice?
I always watch these movies twice because you are so brilliant, I have to try to keep up with you. So the first time, I kind of gloss over it. I watch it just as a movie. The second time, I watch it specifically to notice details that I missed the first time. You'd be surprised what you could pick up the second time around.
Definitely.
Yeah, so I do that just to be, you know, kind of on the same page as you are.
I mean, I don't know. This is the second time period that I've ever seen the movie. And the first time I watched it, I thought it was okay. You know, it was not, you know, this like, you know, I'm going to kind of make a little pun here, but it's not like a Spellbinding movie, you know, or whatever. Not like I didn't have the same feelings like I did with Spellbound. Like Spellbound, I felt was a much, much better, you know, and more Hitchcockian movie. This didn't even feel very Hitchcockian at all. A lot of his normal tropes weren't in it.
Right. Yeah, it's been panned pretty profusely. I went through different reviews also. Trying to study my notes and stuff and take some more notes. And some people gave it 100, some people gave it 50. Different newspapers, you know, the critics. And they said that it really drags and it's, you know, slow-witted and nobody could really act. Well, you know, what's his face? Montgomery Clift is a method actor. So he didn't really emote much. But then that was what his character was about. He was a little stifled. He might even be, I don't know, but a certain type of personality that just doesn't express much.
My favorite story that he said, and I re-listened to an interview that he did, and they were talking about method actors and stuff with Hitchcock, and he said he was working with Montgomery Clift on a movie. You know, he didn't say what, but we know what it was. This is the only one. And he had him coming out of a court, you know, and what he was supposed to do was look to the crowd and then look up. And what he was going to look up and see was a hotel, you know, and there were going to be the words on it, hotel, so that we knew when the person was going to, where the person was going to go, right? Well, you know, Montgomery Clift looks over at him and says, I don't think my character would do that. And do you know what Hitchcock said?
What?
You better or else.
Yeah, they didn't get along much. A lot of friction. Hitchcock wanted his way, and Montgomery Clift wanted his way. So that's what I read anyway. But he is a minimalist. He doesn't express much. He doesn't give away what he's feeling. You don't really see it much. You have to look closely in his eyes or whatever, because he doesn't mug as a lot of actors will do.
And that's fine. He's a more subtle actor, I guess.
And for a priest, I think that's probably even better.
I think maybe that's why, especially that he did it that way for that role. I'm even wondering if he was Alfred's first choice or anything, or if the studio Warner Brothers was pushing him on him, because the reason being is originally he wanted another actress to play the I guess there was no real leading lady, even though there was the girl that Montgomery Clift was having, and it wasn't an affair or anything, but it was sort of was caught seeing, or whatever, and whatnot, a former lover, and everything. And the play by Ann Baxter. Well, originally there was another actress who Hitchcock wanted. Problem is, when they got there, the lady got there, she was she had her lover with her and her kids, and And Warner Brothers just did not want any of that, and said, "You need to cast someone else." So they made him cast Ann Baxter. And it's funny because I've never grown up watching a lot of Ann Baxter's movies, not even All About Eve, so I don't really follow her career. But she was okay in this movie, she wasn't amazing, and I think a lot of that was the writing, her character wasn't fantastic of a character, it's just kind of she was there, that sounds terrible, but
I'm gonna click on something here just for a second. Okay, good. It was an impressive cast, but who I was most impressed with? Somebody I'd never even heard of. O.E. Hess. O.E. Hasse, H-A-S-S-E, obviously another German. Otto Keller. He played
Yes, Otto. what a scumbaggy character. His
eyes alone were so spooky. My God, he could say so much with his eyes.
I know.
Killer.
I think my favorite scene is where, Montgomery Clift knows he's going to be, taken by the police, and he's doing that kind of walk to get out of the church. And Otto the whole time is trying to basically make himself, well, actually the whole time he makes it all about him. You're not going to tell the police. You can't tell the police, blah, 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 blah. And the look that Montgomery Clift gives Otto at that moment of fuck you, dude, basically gives him that, you are, I'm not going to tell your secret, but you're a fucking asshole. With just one look, that scene right there between those two was just so powerful. If anything, that was the best scene in the whole movie, in my opinion.
Well, maybe we're getting the cart before the horse here. Maybe would you like to give the plot so people would know what we're talking about?
All right, let's go through the plot. So it starts with Otto Keller, I believe, committing murder, and then it starts with somebody walking outside, was that because you watched it more than once? Who was that character walking outside with the in the shadow? You saw his shadow.
Allegedly, it was him dressed as a priest, but they probably had a stuntman doing it. Keller, the killer, killed that guy because he wanted his money, right? Claims it was accidental. How do you club a guy? They even mentioned in there he was clubbed so often that it split his skull open. So
Well, here's my opinion on that real quick, even if we're going to jump up a little bit, but in the courthouse scene where they explain that, that he was clubbed that badly and everything like that. Later, I think that was a way for the audience to realize that Otto is a lot more dangerous than what we have come to believe. You know, in my opinion, at that point, I started to go, oh, okay, now he was killed like he's been sort of lying. He's been making himself seem like he's just tried to get out of this thing, but he literally clubbed a dude to death like that. He must have like that was planned at that point, you know, or whatever. And so,
yeah, he was very kind of a pathological liar. But you know, what disgusted me was the fact that, you know, he gave a confession and then he knew the priest couldn't squeal on him, right? Because they take an oath that they'll never reveal a confession. And then he tried to frame the priest for his own actions. And throughout the whole thing, I got more disgusted with this guy. First, I was sympathetic. I was like, okay, maybe he screwed up and, you know, I could forgive this guy. But then he became unforgivable as time went on. We'll get into that later. But
well, you know, and that was one of the things that kind of annoyed me, is that the fact that this priest wouldn't even been a thought in someone's head or whatever, if he hadn't shown up at the house, you know? And I don't know what he was doing. He says he had an appointment, but he knew that guy was dead, you know, and nobody else knew of the appointment. So he didn't ever.
I know why he showed up, because, you know, after I saw it the second time, I realized everything snapped into place. This guy was blackmailing him and Ruth for a seemingly affair, but it wasn't. It was platonic. But the guy held it over their heads for 5 years and finally said, I'll give you 24 hours. You come in with the money or I tell everything to everyone. And so they both showed up trying to talk him out of it. And so it was just a bad timing, the whole thing. He was killed the night before by the other guy, and then made it look like the priest did it.
Yeah. Wow, okay. That makes more sense. See, once again, you need to watch it more than once to really get a lot more shit.
Listening, if you really want to get the full gist of a movie, watch it a second time. It's well worth it, because things that are confusing to you at first will really snap into place later, and you say, oh yes, now I do. You know, it's like The Sixth Sense with Bruce Willis, when everybody saw that, and I see dead people, and
yeah,
realized at the end that Bruce Willis was a dead person. You know, he wasn't just a person, and the kid sees dead people. Well,
yep. Bruce,
but anyway, but you had to see it twice and understand that. So anyway, I didn't really care for the movie much. And I agreed with people, said, you know, it dragged and it sagged. And, you know, it was just kind of people walk through their roles. And then later it's like, no, I think I disagree with that now, my first assumption. And then actually I liked it much better.
The second time. I don't know. It still seems... And maybe because I haven't watched it more than once or whatever, but it just seems sort of like my biggest problem with the movie is the fact that from the very beginning, you know who killed the guy, you know, it was Otto who killed him, right? So there's no suspense with that, right? The suspense becomes like, will the police, you know, find something to arrest this guy on or whatever. And is the priest going to be the one who gets arrested for it? Because, you know, the little children say, oh, we saw a priest leaving the, you know, yeah, leaving thing. That they was don't
really clever of him. And later on, I found out, see, this is another thing I missed. He hid the bloody clothes of the priest in the chest, some kind of a.
Oh yeah. I knew that.
I didn't catch that at first. And it made it look like Father Logan, that's the real priest, did it.
Mm-hmm. And that's what got him arrested, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of was a censure. And he said, well, those aren't my clothes. Well, why were they in your chest of drawers then, or whatever it was?
One with his initials on it.
Yeah. So, but anyway, it was just incredible, the whole thing the girls that they questioned saw a priest, and then it went into the rectory, and actually Father Logan, who is Montgomery Cliff, sees this guy coming in through the back door, and he's inside the church and he goes, is anyone there? And finally the guy jumps out of the shadows and scares him half to death. Mm-hmm. His father, father, I needed to confess. And so he confesses to the murder. And then he said, you know, I'm so guilty of this. And I have to tell someone. And then later on throughout the movie, he uses that against Father Logan.
Well, I mean, that wasn't the original plan. Like, I don't think, because he did not, he wasn't like thinking, I'm going to frame, you know, Father Logan for this. Like, Otto Keller at first didn't seem like a terrible person, right? He seemed like he made a mistake. He accidentally killed somebody. He doesn't want to go to jail because he'll be hung, you know, and everything. But when he does become a terrible person, you know, and because once the fear of getting caught and being hung makes him do these terrible things. And then at the end, he wants, you know, he wants the priest to forgive him.
Yes, at the very end, forgive him.
Forgive me. And I'm like thinking, you kind of don't deserve forgiveness, man. Like, I'm sorry, a priest is still going to forgive you, but like, because that's sort of his holy power, his holy job.
He forgave him too quick. He should have had a pregnant pause there, but anyway, he confesses the homicide, and then he stole $2,000 from the guy. And the next day he goes to work tending a dead man's garden to avoid suspicion. Mm-hmm. His wife says, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm going to do the garden. She says, he's dead. He says, yes, but I go every Wednesday. So in other words, they think I was suspicious if I didn't go, right?
Right.
And then he becomes more paranoid, more desperate, like you said. And then he becomes flat out a framer of the priest that helped him. You know, I mean, you just bite the hand that feeds you, for God's sake.
Paranoia was crazy. The paranoia was nuts because he, like, the whole time he thought that the police were still going to come after him. The police had no...
He thinks he's squealing on him, and he's not, because he took this vow of secrecy and... He withheld and he didn't trust him, I guess. And well, he was German, so that explains maybe a lot during, you know, right after the war, because nobody trusted anybody. So he just was definitely paranoid.
Yep.
Now Logan, remember, maybe I'm jumping ahead. Logan has an alibi, but won't reveal her name. And he looks guilty because of that. And that's Ruth, who he had kind of a platonic affair with. Because before he went and fought World War II, they could have been lovers. And then he went to World War II and then decided to become a priest. But she marries another guy and still in love with him. And so she wants to provide an alibi for him. And it turns into a possible motive for murder, remember? It flip-flops. It backfires on her. And then Carl Malden, who plays the detective, becomes more and more suspicious after the first day when they both showed up at the house of the dead guy. So it just builds and builds and builds, you know, the suspense. And so it is a great Hitchcock movie, but...
Okay, so my big question is, and you said you've seen it twice, so you might know more than I would. So the alibi that she's saying, like that she hung out with him till 11 o'clock or whatever. And I guess the husband agreed to let her say this because he was there, you know, and everything. Which, by the way, can we mention that the husband was my favorite fucking character in the whole movie? So at first I didn't like him because I didn't know him, you know, or whatever, right? Like you first meet him and he gets really upset at his wife for, you know, wanting to be with this other guy, right? And you're thinking, oh man, she's probably wanting to leave him because he seems like a jerk, right? Because he's already getting mad at her. And then you come to realize this guy is the nicest motherfucking dude in the world. Like, he is so freaking sweet. And that's why she fell in love with him. She explains that, right? She fell in love with him because he was this really nice guy to her. And when she needed somebody, he was there and he made her laugh and he treated her well. And, but she wasn't in love with him. She was still in love with the guy she can't have because he went into the priesthood and she can't have him, right? So there was this little bit of like Michael, Priest Logan doesn't want to explain to the cops where he's at because he doesn't want to get in trouble for disobeying priesthood, you know, and stuff. Even though I don't think he did anything once he actually, well, I guess he did spend the night with her in with the storm.
Yeah, but it was in a gazebo in the rain.
They didn't do anything. Yeah. So I don't know why, you know, why even that would be an issue. I guess, honestly, the Catholic Church has always sort of been one of like, if you mess up at all, you know, you're banned, you're gone. You know, you can take off your collar.
But they allow a lot of other things to happen,
though. Well, nowadays it's even worse, but, you know, back in the 50s, I don't know how that was, you know, that was still a lot of like things like that going on that we don't know about.
About Alma, the wife of Otto.
Oh, I loved her too.
She's a very sweet lady, but my dad told me something. I don't know if I should reveal it here. It's going to blow everybody's mind.
Do but it.
In my little town of Calistoga, there was a Catholic church. And there was like three or four priests and a housekeeper. And I said, oh, they have a housekeeper. I guess she just keeps, you know, she washes their clothes and does the dishes and cleans. And my dad says, that's not all she does. So it's like, maybe that's...
He knows that? He knows that for a fact? He knew that for a fact?
But you can't keep a secret in a small town. But anyway, yes. Maybe that's to keep them honest so they won't attack the parishioners. But
maybe
they had people like that. You know, it was in God's work. They're doing God's work.
Keep the priests happy, man. They can't.
Anyway, I was just thinking that whole movie. I wonder what is that all she does. But anyway, they didn't explore that aspect. But you know,
I don't think they could have even back then, especially back then. I don't think they would these days. You know, because the Catholic Church would definitely not approve of any movie talking badly like that.
We can go on a lot of different tangents, but let me just say this real quick, that the guy that wrote this script, Hitchcock, fired because he didn't like the ending, because it was going to be a lot different, a lot more negative than it ended up.
Well, yeah, because the original play was, you know, a lot, you know, different.
Yeah.
You know.
Hitchcock went to a Jesuit school, so he's mesmerized by priests. You know, they had some magical quality, and he liked to entertain also. He didn't want to necessarily educate, which this guy that wrote the screenplay did. He wanted to say, see what happens when you keep secrets, you know, it backfires on you, and then they'll send the wrong guy to prison or whatever. But so anyway, they had a big problem. But Hitchcock had problems with everybody, it seems like.
Mm. So that's interesting that he has that little thing for Catholic priests, but yet he also has a fear of cops. So, you know, you can sort of see that with this movie is like the cops are on the tail of the young priest. So like, you know, like there's that fear there.
Carl Malden played a good sneering kind of, you know, suspecting hard-nosed cop. And he was good at it. And he showed a different side, you know.
I love that because at first they completely buy the alibi. They're like, all right, well, you know, case closed. Like, this guy's not, not case closed, but like, you know, with this guy. And then he finds out it's 11:30. That it actually could have happened at or whatever, like the time of death would have happened about 11:30. And so what?
Food in the stomach that could only have been eaten at 11:30.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they thought, wait a minute, he had an opportunity to kill him before the food was digested.
30 more minutes, man. And that was, I think, was that, wasn't sufficient enough evidence to arrest him, was it? Because, like, that's the problem with this movie.
What happened was she went down, Ruth went down to explain things, and her husband allowed her to be interviewed. And she told them that she loved the priest, and then she told them they were blackmailed over that situation in the rain when they couldn't get in the house,
which took a while for her to do that, because the whole time he did not want her saying that stuff. You know, he kind of kept kind of trying to do his best to like have him not say it, you know, because
the pivotal movement, that pivotal moment in the whole movie is this. I even wrote it down. She goes to the place to be interviewed. She tells him she's blackmailed. Okay. And this makes Logan look guilty, because the alibi now is the motive. It's the motive to kill that guy. She implicated him. And so it turned the whole thing on its head. And this is a Ruth's alibi trying to help clear him, actually implicated him, giving him motive and opportunity. And I thought, oh yes, definitely. So now Otto suspects Logan's squealing on him, and it makes him even more paranoid. So he tells the police Logan seems scared, uses his agitation against him. So he's a rat, no gratitude. The priest secret a confession, and the confessor uses sneaky tactics to frame the priest. I mean, who does that? So a desperate man, obviously.
A desperate man who doesn't want to get hung. You know, that was literally the only, his motivation for any of the stuff he does after after he confesses to the priest is all based on the fact that he's doing everything he can to not get caught up in this. If he hadn't told the priest anything that happened, you know, that he murdered anybody, whatever, none of that would have, like, he would not have ever gotten caught. None of this would have ever happened, you know, if you think about it, because they would have looked around. They would not have found, unless they found something that proved that Otto was there, but they couldn't even find fingerprints on the weapon, the murder weapon. So like, there was literally nothing that would have tied Otto to the whole thing. So had he not confessed, which he could have just confessed to his wife, which he did anyway, you know, right? Like, why did he have to unburden himself with the priest?
I found that transformative, that she at first, you know, was shocked, and then she was complicit, and then by the end of the movie she felt guilty. You know, everybody was relieved in the court, like, we find you not guilty because we can't prove that you did it. And everybody was relieved except for her. And then when she actually ran to the priest and tried to tell that my husband did it, he shot her.
I know, what an asshole.
God, who would do that?
I love that, because he shot her. Then they go after looking for him, right? Because they know he was the one who did it. So they go out and they find him. And then he shoots at the cops or whatever, and they're like, we know you're the one who murdered, you know. And it was like, and then he was like, so the priest told you, and the priest didn't say a thing the whole time. He kept his confession.
Yeah, throughout the whole movie, it gets worse and worse. He just never lets up. He says, it's all because of you. You killed my wife.
I believe at the end, the original script or whatever, that the priest was going to get shot, because there is that scene where he walks up to the guy at the end, and he's like, get away or I'm going to shoot you. And I bet in the original script, he got shot and killed. And that was how it ended.
Oh, that's how it was. But I was counting the bullets. And when the priest went up and said to him, you're not going to shoot me. And I was thinking, you counted the bullets too. You know, there was no more bullets in the gun. So he kept saying, you're not going to shoot me. It's like, you already knew. But
he had faith. He had faith.
Was it courage, or was it just calculations? Like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You're out of bullets, buddy. So
maybe. I don't know. I want to explain this real quick, since we pretty much went through the movie, but we'll probably go dive deeper into some stuff. I know there is a lot. But the one cool thing about this movie was it was one of the first of the Warner Brothers movies, you know, one of the first. I'm not sure which one came first. But what had happened was when Alfred Hitchcock came to America to work with David O. Selznick on like Rebecca and Foreign Correspondent and a few other big time movies and everything, then he later created a company to get away from the Selznick called Transatlantic Pictures. And Transatlantic Pictures produced a few movies, one being Rope, which had a lot of problems with it, mainly due to the homosexual nature of stuff and the fact that back in that time period, people didn't want to see that, you know, that just wasn't very well, you know, wasn't well liked or whatever. So, and then also under Capricorn, I think there was like one or two others that were going to be in Transatlantic Pictures. However, they ended up leaving that company and Warner Brothers ended up taking the movies that were, you know, and this was one of them. And so this was the one of the first of the Warner Brothers movies. And there was 12 writers on this movie throughout the first time. Now, let me read this for real quick. This comes from Wikipedia. So I confess had the longest pre-productions of any Hitchcock film, with almost 12 writers working on the script for Hitchcock over a period of 8 years. Hitchcock had taken time off the wedding of his daughter, Patricia Hitchcock, in 1951, and Hitchcock was in the midst of dissolving his partnership in Transatlantic Pictures with Sidney Bernstein. In the original screenplay, following the source play, the priest and his lover had an illegitimate baby, and the priest was executed at the end of the film. These elements were removed at the insistence of the executives at Warner Brothers, who feared a negative reaction. Also, I did read, I read on one of the books that also it was viewed as the church that they wanted to shoot a lot of the stuff, read the script and said, we will not do that. So that's why that one writer was fired, because he refused to rewrite it, and they brought in another writer. Let's see. This is where it talks about that, because shooting took place in Hollywood in Quebec from August 21st to October 22nd, 1952. So 2 months of filming. Hitchcock had planned on using Quebec churches at no cost when a local diocese, is that how you say it?
Diocese.
Read the original script by George Tabari. It objected to the priest's execution and rescinded its permission. When Tabari refused to change the script, Hitchcock brought in William Archibald to rewrite it. Hitchcock, as was his custom, created detailed storyboards for each scene. And, you know, that's when it goes into
his. That's why they have two names on the credits for writers. I noticed that when I watched it.
Yeah. And then they also had the original like story guy who wrote the play. You know, I believe so. But I don't know if that was in the credits or not. I think it was just the two screenplay writers. But that was, you know, that's sort of interesting. I'm fascinated by that stuff of like how the 1950s and 40s and 30s and all of those years had writers, you know, and how. Fascinated to know, like, if they had 12 writers working on it, like all of them got no credit on it. So I don't know what like they did, if they contributed at all to anything, or if it was all just rewritten from scratch when they rewrote it. But like, I'm interested in knowing more about that stuff, because writers in the 40s and 50s, I mean, it's got to be so much different than it is now, of how they write these things and how they work. Because even then, they said it took them 8 years to make this movie. So they had 8 years basically on and off on the project. Indie filmmakers, you know, it might be 8 years to finish the film or whatever, but that's like, you know, that's a completely different story. You know, that's not... They, you know, you're not getting paid for all 8 years of, you know, of working on this. You know what I mean? Like these people are, you know, they're bringing in people to do that. So it's interesting stuff. I always want to know more about, especially how Hitchcock picked his writers and what, because that guy, the writer, had never done anything. The George Tabari had only done another movie. Actually, nope, I'm sorry, that was the wrong one. William Archibald, I guess, was. So yeah, William Archibald, who got called in to rewrite, he had only done one other thing, which was he had written the movie The Innocents. I don't know if you ever heard of that movie. It was called The Innocents. It was, nobody that I know of big is in this. Like Michael Redgrave is in it, and Deborah Kerr. It's a horror film too. It says a young governess for two children become convinced that the house and grounds are haunted. And originally it was called The Turn of the Screw. Is a Henry James short story or story, you know. But yeah, he co-wrote it with Truman Capote, of all people.
Truman Capote, wow.
Yeah, so it was interesting to see that, but like that writer hadn't really done anything besides maybe written that script or whatever at that point. So it's interesting to see, like, how does Hitchcock pick these writers? You know, like, I'd be fascinated in finding that out because, you know, sadly, I don't know who to ask now. Maybe Hitchcock connoisseurs or something, you know?
I don't know what process he used, but he was very temperamental and very selective. And he held grudges too, Hitchcock. Oh, did you see where he came in at his little cameo?
I did not. I know of it. It was like in the beginning of the movie, and it's right after the opening credit scene. Yeah. It's like right then. And yes. I missed it.
Real quick, because when they were showing a montage of the city itself, the alleys and different things, and he's walking at the top of a staircase.
That's all he's doing is just walking? Bless you.
Just walking across. There was this distant shot. You wouldn't even have known it was him.
Nice.
Man walking across. But anyway, God, there's just so much to talk about in this. It's just, did you notice that near the end, when the wife is shot, before she dies, she tells everybody, "Forgive me," or to more to the priest.
Yeah, she says it in her language, doesn't she? And they're like, "What did he say?" Or she say, and he said, "Forgive me."
Yeah, they wanted her to tell who the killer was, but she said, "Forgive me." Well, you just associate her with him, so Keller the killer, right? Interesting name choice. It's just one vowel difference.
Yep, Keller the killer. It was interesting when he's caught at the end and he's like, you know, "What about my wife?" And they're like, "She's dead. You like killed her." You know?
It's like, what? Excuse me. But the whole movie's trashing the priest that tried to help him. My God. I mean,
poor guy. I mean, this is definitely Hitchcock's like wrong man type thing where, you know,
exactly. It's his theme: innocent man falsely accused. So
yep, poor guy. I mean, Montgomery Clifton deserved this, you know. He was a good guy. Now come to think of it, like, so I understand with a lot of Hitchcock stuff, Hitchcock likes to have like little funny little moments and you know, things like that. What's up with the priest and the bicycle?
Levity. I thought it was overdone, but
it got a little annoying. It's like, what are you, like, when he's like, "How far are you gonna bring this in there?" And the guy just laughs, you know. And I'm just like,
yeah, it's a British thing probably,
I guess, but it just felt weird. It was like, do we have to, I mean, did any of this need to be in the movie, you know? Could, I mean, if they left all of that out, it still would have been, I think, an interesting movie, you know, or whatever.
Or humorous.
It just annoyed me after a little bit. Like, I was just like, why does this guy, is there a point to this bicycle?
This was a drama. And maybe in a horror movie where you need a little levity once in a while to take a breath because you're right. being scared to death. And that would work, but not in a drama like that. I don't know. But I also felt the same way. It's like, we don't need this.
You know.
Maybe once, you know. Or
if, I mean, in the beginning when they just mentioned his bicycle and how it annoyed them or whatever, that is just enough, you know. But then they show other scenes with the bicycle. I'm just like, I'm done. Like, stop, you know. Like, I move on. I'm, you know, I don't want to see that shit. So that annoyed me. But all in all, to, when I said earlier, this is just an okay Hitchcock movie. It's not terrible, and it's not necessarily the, you know, like, I like Strangers on a Train better, and it feels like it's sort of like Strangers on a Train, you know, right? Like, it feels that way, where it's a guy who is wrongly accused of murder and somebody else, you know, and he knows who the killer is, but he can't do anything. He can't, you know, like, in that one, he's like fear of getting killed over it.
And usually we don't really know. And that's because he likes suspense.
The mystery.
So there's no suspense. It's just suspense about what's going to happen. Now, I love the ending where it said, he confesses the original murder, a trick by Inspector LaRue. And I have a point here somewhere, but I just went out of my head. He runs into the grand ballroom of the Chateau of Frontenac or whatever it is.
Right.
They trick him into confessing, and as if we didn't know that they already did it, but they didn't. I know my point. Okay. You notice they said to shoot him in the shoulder.
Right.
How far we've evolved. Somebody chased down a shoplifter and shoot him in the back now. But in the old days, just wing the guy. And that's my very thought. Why don't you just shoot the guy in the leg if you're chasing somebody?
Right.
Oh, no, we're afraid to do that. It might ricochet and hit somebody else. That's just a flimsy excuse to kill people. You don't need to kill somebody to stop them. Shoot him somewhere else in the butt. You know, they'll stop. But then they shoot his shoulder. And then apparently that wasn't enough. And so they did kill him finally. But I thought, how far we've come in the bad direction. You know, nowadays, just shoot first, ask questions later, you know.
Well, that's the way that, like, I mean, that's why we have a lot of people defunding the police and doing all that stuff or whatever. Where, I mean, I wonder what Hitchcock would think about the defunding the police and all this other stuff nowadays, you know, like, if he were living today, how would he feel about all this stuff that's going on?
Like, police anyway, but
yeah.
He might have been on the side of the defund the police, yeah.
Probably.
I want to read you real quick. I just used two newspapers of all the reviews as examples. The one that gave the best review was the San Francisco Chronicle. They said it's a forgotten masterpiece. It might never catch fire, but it smolders gloriously. That was a nice quip. And then the worst one was the New York Times. They said, so scrupulously acted that it tends to drag, sag, and grow dull. That's a two different points of view. I think some people hated it, some people loved it, and most were in the middle. But it wasn't one of his best, arguably, but it wasn't one of his worst, and it's still worth a watch. So anybody that wants to catch it, you know, really, really focus on the little details, because that's where the story really lies. And also the music was hauntingly beautiful. I loved it, by Dmitri Tiomkin. Beautiful, beautiful music.
What else did he do?
I'm not sure. I didn't look him up, but didn't have the time to do that. But check up Dmitri Tiomkin. Tiomkin, maybe he's Russian. Let's see.
Oh, he did a lot of westerns. He did music for like he did music for High Noon.
Oh.
And things like that. Let me see. Let me see what he composed. So he did A Gentleman After Dark. Let's see. The Moon and the Sixpence, Shadow of Doubt. He did music for that, which we reviewed. The Unknown Guest, Battle of Russia. Seems okay to talk about that now. Attack, Battle of New Britain. Dillinger, he did the one for the Dillinger. I think, did Cagney do that? Uh-huh. No, that's Lawrence Tierney Dillinger movie. Let's see. Jesus Christ, what else? Oh, it's, oh my God, he did the music to It's a Wonderful Life.
Did he really?
Yeah, and Duel in the Sun.
Wow, he was somebody.
He was I never even heard of this guy. I need to look more into him because he's got a crazy career. He did Strangers on a Train.
So Hitchcock,
Hitchcock loved him, I guess, you know.
Yeah, all of them liked him anyway.
You kept using him. Yeah, he did Dial in for Murder as well. And
wow.
What else? Damn, dude.
Go-to guy.
Yeah, Gunfight at the OK Corral.
Huh.
So, yeah, wow, this guy is incredible. Just look him up, everybody. Dmitry Tiomkin. I guess he might be Russian, something like that.
Seems like it. Of course, that doesn't mean anything. My nephew's named Dmitry, and he's Irish. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Otto, the guy that plays Otto. My God. I'd never really heard of him before. His name is O.E. Hasse, H-A-S-S-E.
Mm-hmm.
Eyes alone, he's so expressive. And it's just, he speaks with his eyes, but he played a great desperate maniac. He's just very impressive. And so I really enjoyed him probably better than anybody else. You know, like Montgomery Clift was a minimalist. Well, O.E. Hasse, who played Otto Keller, the killer, was just the opposite of that. So,
well, interesting. I just found something out about O.E. Haas or whatever. So Alfred Hitchcock cast O.E. Haas, a powerful character actor trained by Max Reinhardt, who had started his screen career as an extra for F.W. Murnau as the killer, Dolly Haas, a popular German star of the early 1930s before fleeing Hitler, was cast as his wife. Hitchcock remembered Haas fondly from the British remake of D.W. Griffith's Broken Blossoms. So, where she acquitted herself. What?
That's not his real wife, even though it's spelled H-A-A-S. Dolly Haas played his wife. But he has an E in back of his. O-H-A-S-S-E is his name. So they're similar, but not.
Yeah, it's interesting that they both were German, you know, well, I guess.
The movie was pretty much German, except for Montgomery Clift and Ann Baxter. And
I guess. Well, Carl Madden, apparently, or Maiden, or whatever his name is, he was good friends with Montgomery Clift. And the main reason, like, he was excited to work with them was because apparently Montgomery Clift had drinking issues, you know, and stuff. And he knew that Carl would help him, you know, manage himself, you know, so that he could, you know, act and not get, I guess, get drunk on set, you know, which would be a disaster, you know. But, you know, it's interesting to, like, look back at all these films where, like, the 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, where alcoholism reigned a lot, you know, or whatever, you know. Yeah, and a lot of people were drunk on sets and different things.
It was celebrated. It was like, have a cocktail and a Marlboro. It was alcohol.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories to tell was Ed Wood. When Ed Wood, you know, that director, the guy did like Play a Nine from Outer Space and Bride of the Monster and all these B movies, Johnny Depp played him in a biopic that Tim Burton did, one of my favorite films of all time. And studying Ed Wood, I found out that during the movie Night of the Ghouls, which is this just, I mean, not many people know of it unless you're an Ed Wood fan, you know, you've never probably heard of it. He was right before they started filming their first, you know, stuff or whatever. They had a bar right next to where they were shooting, you know, so he went to the bar and just started buying everybody drinks with the production money, you know, that they were going to use. So he just started buying everybody drinks. Then he ran out of money. They're all having a fun time hanging out. And then when it came to shooting, he was like, oh shit, I don't have enough money to pay the cast.
Oh my God.
And so Tor Johnson, who was this big hulky guy, you know, said, hey, I need my money and I'm not coming out until I get paid. And they're like, well, sorry, but you know, he's not getting paid today. And so Tor Johnson left, you know, but that just makes me go like, you know, I wonder how many people, I guess in Hollywood, it's different because you have to sort of, I mean, they have to be more professional about that stuff or they're going to get fired, you know.
Amazing stories, real-time stories from sets I've been on, but I can't.
Yeah, it's probably better that you don't.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't like people being drunk on set. People have been drunk on my sets and stuff. I don't like it, but like, you know, either you fire the person for doing that or you have it in your contract that nobody is allowed booze, you know, on during, you know, because I can't tell somebody that they can't drink before something. I can't tell them that they can't drink after something, you know, but I can tell them not to be drunk on my set, you know. So but yeah, that's a little bit like back in the 30s, I guarantee you there were a lot of, or 40s and 50s and all that. So there was a lot of that stuff going on.
Yeah, it was just accepted more. But I was amazed at some of the people like Humphrey Bogart, who was an alcoholic, and some of the other people that I don't even want to mention names, but they'd stand and deliver these monologues. Did they have cue cards for them or what? How could they memorize these things if they're drunks? I just never could figure that out.
Never could either, you know. There are people still to this day that use cue cards, you know. You know, I think you know a few. it's okay. I mean, whatever gets you to be able to do those lines, you know.
Yeah. Well, now they have pieces too that they use, so.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's known as Johnny Depp is one of them. So I'm not going to get sued for that. But you know, there's a few others I could mention that uses an earpiece. So
yeah, and
he talks about, I, you know, people know.
Okay, good. Because I don't want Johnny Depp getting all upset at this podcast. I don't think he'll even know that we had this discussion. What?
Edit that one.
Nah, it's being left and he'll be all right. He'll be okay. I praised him for being in Ed Wood. He was great in that. But yeah, it's interesting to know that a lot of these people drank back then and whatnot. And it's just, but I didn't know Montgomery Clift had a drinking issue, you know, or whatever. And that's not surprising, you know, that's a lot of what goes on in Hollywood. There's a lot of people, you know, back then there was AA. So maybe he was an AA. I don't know. You know, maybe he wasn't.
Or not.
Or not.
He was.
What?
Tried to bare knuckle it.
Yeah. A lot of people. Yeah. They white knuckle it. Yeah.
Yeah. White knuckle it. Yeah. They tried to do it themselves. They go to a bar and have a Coke with all their cronies everybody else is having something else, but that's a hard way to do it. You know, I wouldn't advise it.
Yeah, especially if you're like sort of not, if you haven't drank in like, you know, a couple months or something, you know, it's probably, and you have an issue with alcohol, you know, you probably shouldn't go to a bar and pretend to drink. I know it happens, you know, people say they're going to go do that and then they, you know, whatever, but that's all on them.
Well, some people fall off the wagon, some people jump. So
I never heard that, but that's funny. I like that. Okay, so what else there? You said there was a bunch of stuff.
I just wanted to talk about more about why Hitchcock would make this particular film at this particular time. This is 1953, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is right after World War II. He has a bunch of Germans in a French film or in a French location. I'm thinking, was he saying something by doing that and without saying it? Because a lot of Nazis escaped to South America, as we all know, and maybe up to Quebec too. But
maybe
this is a French city; they all speak French up there. I've been there, and I, you know, I didn't speak much French, and they didn't speak any English. Some of these people. And to have French actors, I mean, a German actor speaking, you know, with German accents. And I thought, this is strange. But I don't know if he's trying to say anything about the Catholic Church, particularly. Maybe he thought it was a little too stringent and restrictive on the priests. You know, no matter what, they can't reveal the confession, and so they have to go down to take the rap for this other guy. I mean, this is a little far-fetched, I guess, but it could happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a very odd that these two people kind of merged in their trajectories through life, and how just one of them is innocent but is falsely accused, and then the person who confessed to the crime actually helps put him down even further. And I thought, what an evil son of a bitch. So it's just like, wow. But I couldn't take my eyes off of this killer. You know, he's just so expressive, but even though it's disgusting, and it made for a very good drama. So anyway, just my take on that. Let's see. But the theme that you rightly said earlier, that, you know, the theme is about an innocent man falsely accused. And Hitchcock does this over and over and over
again. Yep. Usually with trains or whatever, you know, and there were no trains in this movie. Hold on.
And the priest is mobbed, vocally assaulted, spit on near the lab when he takes that walk to the car. And I'm thinking of Jesus Christ. I'm no pun intended. He was a Jesus-like character because he was just too forgiving. No matter what, he wouldn't break down and say, okay, all right, you know, this guy did it. He was too Christ-like. And remember when Christ walked the last mile or something, people spit on him and threw rocks at him. And then he broke the window with his elbow. I mean, the priest, not the Christ, but it was just amazing. I was seeing parallels here. And so he just stubbornly refuses to reveal that confession and almost dies for it. And apparently in the play, he does.
Well, interestingly enough, I just read this. Cognizant of the difficulty non-Catholics would have in understanding the priest's reluctance to expose Keller, Alfred Hitchcock said, "We Catholics know that a priest cannot disclose the secret of confessional. But the Protestants, the atheists, and the agnostics all say, ridiculous. No man would remain silent and sacrifice his life for such a thing."
Exactly.
And so, yeah, it is interesting that, like, yeah, he was going to go to jail and be hung for a murder that he didn't commit just because he could not tell anybody what happened. What actually, he knew the killer, you know, like, he... Yeah. could do this at any time. And it tried me nuts as a person who's not Catholic, you know. I think even if I were Catholic, I'd still feel like, you know, terrible and going, oh my God, I wish you could just tell them, please tell them, you know, save yourself.
Tell them by secrecy. And so he can't even protect himself. But
So apparently there were a couple people in line to play that Hitchcock wanted to play, but Warner Brothers turned them down to play the lead, Father Logan. And the first one was James Stewart, Jimmy Stewart. And he would have been an interesting person, but I don't know if I would have liked it. I'm not a fan of Jimmy Stewart. I think we've talked about this before, but I'm not a huge Jimmy Stewart fan. Like,
It was an imaginary rabbit, actually. I wasn't even at the scene.
You doing a little Harvey there?
Yeah, exactly.
But and then the other one was Laurence Olivier, who I actually would have preferred over Montgomery Clift. I like Laurence Olivier a little better, you know.
He might have been theatrical. I think Clift turned out fine because he's so laconic. You know, he didn't say much.
Well, also a lot of that might have been due to his drinking, because I just read that a lot of his issues were because he drank too much on set.
Who?
Not Lawrence. Montgomery Clift. So a lot of his Montgomery Clift drank during the shooting, and his eyes appeared glazed during the ferry scene. Hitchcock was a very non-confrontational director, and delegated an assistant director in Carl Malden as well to talk to Clift about it. There's a couple other ones that I read about his drinking causing, but
I know a little bit about his backstory. He was tormented because he was bisexual, and he never quite overcame that.
I think a lot of actors were either bisexual or they were gay, yeah, and they couldn't come out and say it. And so they hid these lives. Like, have you seen, there's a great show on Netflix that was produced by Brian Murphy, the guy who did like Glee and American Horror Story, but it's called Hollywood, and it's about old school Hollywood. And it's about how gay Hollywood actually was back in the 1950s, but not a lot of it's ever talked about because of, you know, how sort of secret.
Gas stations you could go to and match up with somebody.
That's what that show's about.
Yeah, yeah.
That show's about that. Have you seen it?
Well, no, but maybe I have. I don't know. I saw it somewhere.
But yeah, there was gas stations where you would go to the gas station and then you would hook up with the person. It was sort of like, you know, it would either be a girl or a guy. It didn't matter, you know.
House of prostitution. It was called Hidden Hollywood or something. I have.
No, it's called Hollywood is the show that I watched.
There was one called like Hollywood Babylon. It's all about scandals that occurred, you know.
Yeah.
Notorious cases like the Fatty Arbuckle case and, you know, all of this stuff. And they used to have orgies, you know, every night somewhere in the city. It's a very interesting place.
But yeah, definitely.
So the 30s was even worse than it is today.
I believe so. Hold on. I'm trying to. Yeah, Rock Hudson was also another actor that I think was, you know, had a lot of those issues and stuff.
I don't know if he drank. He just.
I think he was gay or something or whatever. Yeah.
Completely gay. He said they tried to marry him off to a secretary of one of the studios just to make him look legitimate. And like after the second night of marriage, he said, damn it, get me a boy.
Yeah, man, that's funny.
And my sister worked with him in Napa Valley, played the Grapes of Wrath or something. Or This Earth Is Mine, I forget which one it was, but she came home and said, this is in the 50s. She said, did you know Rock Hudson is gay? But not many people knew about it. They kept it hush-hush. So, yeah.
Interesting.
Press went along with it. They didn't reveal it like they do today. They're trying to get dirt on people.
So. That's crazy. Well, I think that's about this about wraps it up. Is there any last minute ones that you wanted to make sure we touched upon?
I just like the way Cliff played it, internalized emotions, very realistic. I think about a certain priest that, you know, that hid his feelings and kept it inside.
Yeah, he did a good job with that, especially. He was very cold at times, you know?
Yeah. I'm thinking, is he always like this?
But then, I think his character was like that because his character had to sort of be like that. He couldn't come out and say, you know, like, I'm still in love with this girl, you know, who's married, you know what I mean? Like, he had to just sort of, you know, because priests can't do anything, you know, they can't have relationships, even if it was from a previous relationship, you know.
Is his real life character, I mean, his personality, is that more leaning in that direction? So he's perfectly cast, or is he been in other movies where he's a chatterbox and he laughs and he's clowning? I'd like to see something, see the difference and how great that acting role was. I'm just thinking, if he's really like that in real life, then it wasn't much of an acting job. But
right. I don't know. Maybe. I'd have to check out some more of his films and see how more lively he is. It sort of annoys me too when I see these films where the actors are just so one note, you know, a lot of times. Like when I see you in movies, you are three-dimensional, which means that like you have different emotions at different times. We just watched a movie and I won't say what, but you would know what it is if I mentioned that. You worked in a building or whatever, and there was a janitor, you know, and everything, that movie. And that's actually got reviewed for Indie Film Cafe, by the way. I'll tell you more about that later, yourself personally. But your character was this just lively guy that did this stuff, but had like your emotions went from different things and all that stuff. And that just showed you were just a talented actor. I feel like a lot of times I see these actors, and even Montgomery Clift was sort of one note, you know, he delivered everything sort of the same. And maybe that's another reason I didn't like the movie, as I just kind of, after a while, you're following this guy around and he's not giving a lot of emotion, you know, he's sort of doing it. He's sort of frustrated, but not, you can't really tell. Like as I said before, my only favorite scene is him giving that look to Keller, you know, of basically back off me, man. You know, like I'm taking the heat for you. And he says all he needs to say in that, just that one look. And I was like, okay, that was good acting right then and there. But aside from that, I don't know. He just, a lot of times he just kind of, when he was talking to the girl, he was talking the same way. He was, you know, it felt the same in every emotion, you know, thing. He barely ever had any three dimension to me.
I agree. No. So, I don't know. I have to see something else by him to see if he can act. But he must have been. He was one of the most popular actors at the time.
He was a very popular actor at the time. So I don't know. I guess he was a great, I mean, I, what else has he been in that I would even know him from?
Can't think of anything. I'm sure I've seen him as something.
From Here to Eternity, oh, wow. Red River, and A Place in the Sun, and The Search are the biggest movies he's been in, I guess.
That was a Frank Sinatra epic. They didn't want him, but he campaigned for the role and he did a great job.
Yeah, Montgomery Clift played Robert E. Lee in it. I guess it was a Civil War movie.
From Here to Eternity?
Yeah.
Oh,
I see. Robert E. Lee Pruitt was requested Army transfer and ended up in Schofield, his new captain.
Military movie.
Yeah. Frank Sinatra is in it. Yeah.
Ernest Borgnine too, and played a great role. He was the medieval sergeant that cruelly, tormented these guys. But it's a great movie, one of the great movies.
I'll have to check it out at some point. That's just so many movies I need to watch, man. And I just don't have time to watch them all.
Yeah, so little time.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, thank you so much, Larry. Like, this has been so much fun, and I really enjoyed this episode. And next month, we've got The Wrong Man that we'll be talking about, and I'm excited about that. It sounds like it's right up the Hitchcock alley of The Wrong Man. It's in the title, so it better be. You know, that'd be funny if it isn't. You know. But I'm excited to see that one again. I haven't seen him forever. So it's, you know, another reason why I like doing these reviews is because I get to rewatch movies that I haven't seen in forever and, you know, refresh myself. I Confess was one of them that I was really excited to check out. And I hope everybody enjoys this. This is going to be out on April Fool's Day, but this isn't a joke. This is real. So, you know, it's just perfect timing that April Fool's fall on the first Friday of the month.
That's true.
You know,
it's coming up.
I know, right? Two more days. I'll have this up and scheduled tonight. So no problem. Thank you so much, man, because this is a lot of fun and it was great to chat with you about this. And I know you do a lot of research and you do a lot of, you know, you check up on these things. So I really appreciate that. There's just in this one movie, I didn't even think about it. There were a lot of stuff in it, you know, probably even stuff we didn't get to discuss. Maybe we'll have to revisit it at some point.
Absolutely. Yeah. So anyway, well, we'll be working together on one of your movies soon.
Right? Soon enough, you'll be back in Virginia. I can't wait.
Yeah.
Okay. So, all right. Well, thank you so much. And everybody else, we appreciate you guys checking this out. Give us a chat soon and let us know how everything's going. All right. Bye, everybody.